You'll have to ask me about outside resources too. So I got the children all x-rayed. They had a nurse there. And I found 20 active cases of tuberculosis out of 140. And this impressed me deeply because of one thing, they hadn't been previously examined, and secondly, because tuberculosis was pretty prevalent amongst the Eskimos and Indians.
This told you that?
This told me that, very, my first exposure to it, because we had nothing in like that in the valley. And as I said, 5 are positive sputums, and we took them and put them under treatment. In those days, no drugs, bed rest, good diet, and pneumothorax. Do you know what that is? That's blowing, putting air into this, into the cavity around the lungs, pleural cavity, injecting a Novocaine and then putting a big needle in and pumping air in, collapsing the lung. So if they had cavities from tuberculosis, that would be collapsed and be helped the process of healing. That or surgery, which I didn't perform, of course, but that was all we had in those days. No heroic drugs. But this solved the tuberculosis problem at that school, and I set up with a nurse a program for the other 20. I had had knowledge that tuberculosis was in Alaska, but I hadn't been exposed to the real thing till the school work. But in Philadelphia, I had taken special training in tuberculosis, knowing this, and I was prepared for it. That was also a source of supporting our hospital. So we were now in good stead. We didn't have many minors, but one fractured femur was in the hospital for 6 months. So.
And what about outside sources?
Well, we had a cause, we thought, in the Matanuska Valley, something unique. Alaska was unique to most people in the United States, so I thought that there was no reason why some our big foundations like the Kellogg Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, why they couldn't maybe support us a bit. And I needed help. I needed money to get another doctor. Things were growing. So I went to the Kellogg Foundation in Michigan and to the Rockefeller Foundation in New York and the Friends Society in Philadelphia, and they all saw me and heard my story, but no money. And then I went to Washington and got to the Children's Bureau that was interested in children and in mothers. And we were able to negotiate a special project, as we called it. And believe it or not, it was to demonstrate that hospital deliveries was the safer and better way in a rural community. And we'd already decided that, but we were going to prove it now. And that's what they granted it to us for, about $50,000 a year. And this really gave us security, and we didn't stop with 5 nurses, we had more than that, and finally did get a doctor. Dr. Leroy Flora came there the last year that I was there before I was called into the service.
Was the money needed mostly for the TB effort?
No, it was the Children's Bureau was interested in good care for children, prenatal care, they were emphasizing. Visits, in fact, I had to have them, my mother visit me every month. That was a requirement. Certain specifications came out of the grant. And It was a stimulus, and he kept very careful record in his reports.
In general, it was your practice to keep parents from interfering in the work you did at the hospital. Is that right?
Well, one has to be judicious about that. That the parents can be time-consuming, demanding, unnecessarily. So as much as we could avoid that, we did, because we were alone. And that was the case with the tonsillectomies. Instead of having five parents coming in every evening, going through all of the routines, and there was no financial signing, that had all been done before. They'd already approved their operation, but there wasn't any business to take care of, so it was proper to pick the child up and bring him to the hospital. And we could solve two problems, as I mentioned before. And we had great cooperation from the people.
It's the issue of hospital versus home deliveries is one that's being raised again a lot, with midwifery becoming more popular.
Well, I think in certain circumstances today, the centers are prepared to take care of any abnormalities or any emergency situations that develops in pregnant mothers, and they're pretty well categorized to know whether or not they can have a home delivery or whether they can have one in the hospital. But there are areas in the United States where we've got to do better. We're still having a pretty bad infant death rate compared to some nations in the world. We haven't solved it, so we've got to try. We had one apparent crib death in my time in Alaska. A little infant died for unknown reason, and later on we've had them described as crib deaths. But we had a healthy population, mothers. There were a few that were going to be a little difficult, and I sent them to Anchorage, especially if they might have needed a cesarean because of the small measurements in their pelvis. But we had natural deliveries in Palmer. Just a few were sent to Anchorage. And none were needing cesareans, as long as I was associated there.
And how long were you the doctor at that hospital, and then what took you away?
Well, in 1935, I started in June, and December of 41, I was called in before Pearl Harbor to in the Army. And Fort Richardson was already in existence, had a hospital, and they needed a general surgeon. And I was called in and served there, and I stayed in the Army 4 years. And at the same place, I, you know, the Army system, you're promoted, and your position changes because of your promotion. And I was chief of surgery then for 2 years, and then I became executive officer of the hospital, and finally commanding officer at the end. And this was had a great impact on me, because I was a clinician. I wanted to be with patients, and loved patients, could do something for them. And I get promoted in the Army, and now I'm an executive officer as far as paperwork and so on, and administration. Well, you have to do that. job. And then when I got to be commanding officer and post-surgeon, it was a total administration. And we had wonderful generals, Mittelstedt from San Francisco. And we had to take care of our men and women who were nursing. We were preparing for the invasion of Japan and had a 1,500-bed hospital ready in Anchorage, Fort Richardson, when I was commanding officer. And we were expecting to be bombed, so we dispersed our hospital facilities out in the woods all over towards the mountains. And living out there, we had no movies, no recreation at all, so I had to do something for my men and women. And so I got a skating rink up and a Red Cross building for movies and shows. And we used to have the big name people like Olivia de Havilland and Berglund and others come to give the shows, not only at our place, but also on the base. But we did such a good job there, and the morale was so high that they didn't want to go back to town. We were having a better time out in the dispersal out in the woods. But that's part of administration, I think, you know, not just doing paperwork. And that got me into trouble, because Mittelstedt tells Governor Greening that I've got to get out of the Army because I'm now a full colonel. The only place that I could serve was ADAC, and that didn't attract me at all. And the reason for that was because the war was winding down and Alaska became less important. Japan was collapsing from the south push, so the northern pincers wasn't necessary. So here I am, a full colonel, and they had to do something with me, either put me out or send me to ADAC, and I figured coming out was better. And that's when Greening got me to be commissioner of health, which was another sad decision at first.
Why was it tough for you to do?
Well, that meant I'm not getting back to the valley, back to patients.
It meant going to Juneau.
And it meant to going to Juneau. And I had a beautiful home in the valley, and here I've got a 10 by 10 yard in the Juneau, and rain all the time. But here's where my prayers came into action again. That was the kind of a life I live. I keep the doors open and opportunities ahead of me. So the answer to that question is I became commissioner of health.
And tell us about that. What was the big goal of your tenure?
Well, I wasn't prepared as a public health physician at all in medical school. We didn't have preventive medicine much or public health. Then I had experienced the wisdom in preventive medicine, infectious diseases and tuberculosis and spread in the valley, in my Eklutna vocational school. So Ernest Greening, a great man that he was, you know, he was a physician. Governor Ernest Greening was an MD. So we related very well, and he said, "Earl, I don't know much about public health either, but we'll learn together. But we've got to do something about tuberculosis and get a health department started in Alaska." And the interviews with him were so challenging and so inspiring, which was really what they were. I was able to make the adjustment. And as far as having lost the contact with patients, I regained that by working with tuberculosis patients in the 400 bed, I think it was maybe not 400 bed, 100 bed hospital in Sitka we made into a crippled children's hospital. They were all my patients, you know, in the health department. So that changed the course of my life, and I got into administration and public health and preventive medicine, which is what I've been doing ever since 1945, that aspect of medicine.
How bad was tuberculosis then? This was 1945.
We didn't know. And we had to know. So the first thing was to find out. And let me give you a little insight into Governor Greening's wisdom and politics. He said, Earl, we've got to let the people of Alaska know that tuberculosis is a problem. And I said, well, don't they know that now? And he said, no, they don't. So I searched out and found out the Alaska Tuberculosis Association, which was in existence, a private voluntary group still in existence, had done some x-ray surveys, not for statistical purposes, but to treat people to who in Anchorage had tuberculosis or who had it in Wasilla, you know, so they could get care. But they were valuable statistics for me when presented to people that we had to do something about it, and we had an opportunity because the war was over. And there were hospitals that were being abolished by the Army and Navy. So Greening said, Earl, I want you to go out and tell the people how bad tuberculosis is. And I said, well, they know it already. He says, but they have to be impressed, and then they have to write letters to me, and we've got to do something about it. Well, that all sounded a lot of waste of time to me, but he was a politician. He says, I've got to have a stack of letters. For what reason? To call a special session of the legislature. And that's just what happened. I went out to church groups and to Kiwanis clubs or wherever there was one, and Rotary clubs, and talked about this. And they would write letters to the governor, and in 1946, already in 1 year's time, he called a special session of the legislature for funds for tuberculosis control and veterans benefits as a result of World War II, and that's a special session of 46. It's a very interesting session. And we got a group together.
So Greening was able to call a special session, and were you successful?
Well, he called it for two purposes: to get some funds for tuberculosis control and authority. We didn't have a law about it. And the second was for veterans' pensions. So with the buildup that we had managed throughout the territory and the people supporting it, it wasn't difficult to raise $250,000. But let me remind you that this was one-tenth of a total annual appropriation of the territorial government. They were biennial sessions. $5 million was the total appropriation. So this was real significant and showed real desire on the part of the territorial government to do something about it. Now, with that money, we could go back to Washington, to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Interior, and ask for matching money, at least some support, in two ways. One, to support our staff, and secondly, to pay for the hospitalization of their beneficiaries, the natives of Alaska, Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts. And we had figured that we ought to get at least $400,000. Well, in Washington, it was decided that the U.S. Public Health Service should get into the program, in addition to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So with their support and their desire to send some of their trained tuberculosis experts assigned to our department, we ended up with over $1 million from the federal government, some going to the Public Health Service and some going to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Well, with this kind of money, we were able to make certain major decisions. One of them is we must find the cases, and that's case finding. And we had a four-legged program: case finding, treatment, education, and rehabilitation of the tuberculosis patients. The case finding with Alaska spread out like it was necessitated four different methods of finding the cases. In those days, the Alaska Railroad was the only road from Anchorage, Seward to Fairbanks. So we had to have a railroad unit. We got a car from the Alaska Railroad, made it into a clinic, put an x-ray on it in an outpatient department, and a living quarters for the staff right on the train. So it would be pulled up to Wasilla, the sidetrack, and x-ray everybody that we could get. Go up to Curry, do the same thing, and all along the railroad, we x-rayed everybody that would volunteer. It wasn't mandatory, but we had no problem there. It was very rarely that people wouldn't get their chest x-rayed. They were developed right on the spot and sent back to Juneau for interpretation. We had a specialist that the Public Health Service were sending us to read the x-rays, thousands of them. Then we had to have a highway unit. And that was a truck fixed up with an x-ray unit and one doctor. And they went to Talkeetna and the spots along the highway towards Valdez, Richardson Highway, and x-rayed the people in Eskimos. This was not limited to the Eskimos and Indians, it was everybody. Then the biggest success was the Marine units. That was not started by us at that time because they had taken a yacht and converted it into a Marine unit, a small yacht with an x-ray on it and a doctor. And we found out that it was too small. It was not adequate to do the work. So we decided to get some Army surplus units, 128 footers, that were used during the war for personnel transportation and freight transportation. It had a big 50 by 50 hold that we rebuilt into a clinic. And it was large enough for a doctor, a nurse, a lab technician, dentist, and a dental assistant. So now we had a real unit that we could visit all the places like Hoonan, Ketchikan, and Kodiak, and Seward, all of these places, and all of the native villages in Southeastern and so on.
Did it go off the Bering Sea coast too?
Yes, it did. Aleutian Chain. We go out for 6 months at a time. Then we got another one. We had two units and converted a barge with great big huge outboard motors on it that went up the Yukon. And as a result of all of this case finding, oh, and then finally, I didn't think of the airplane. And they had cases of equipment, went to places that could not be approached by water, or road, or railroad. That was also successful. We even had ordered an airplane to be bought by the state territory, but for an ambulance, but that was never delivered because the manufacturers or those who were converting it had a fire and destroyed it, so we never got it. But we used chartered planes to get the equipment out into the boondocks.
And what did that look like? Was it a big trunk?
Norseman. Oh, airplane.
Was it a great big trunk full of X-ray machines?
Yeah, trunks, X-ray equipment. And of course, we had to have technicians to go along. And you know, we were very fortunate in being able to get good qualified people. We saw to it that we got them, but there was a lure about Alaska, and this was a big public health project, and they wanted to be part of it. It was exciting, really was. And in the meantime, Seward Sanatorium gets to be a first-class sanatorium. We hired doctors, chest surgeons for that. The famous one was Dr. F.J. Phillips, who's still living in Anchorage. And he was a chest surgeon and made a great contribution to the success of the project. In those days, we had no heroic drugs. It was surgery now, collapsing the lungs, taking the ribs out and literally collapsing the complete lung.
Take the ribs right out.
Take the ribs right out. Remind me, and I'll tell you a great story about what was done with those ribs. And Dr. Phillips was introduced a wonderful program, the fourth leg of the treatment program, which was rehabilitation. He started the program while he had these patients, sometimes for 2 years. To train them into certain aspects of life that were important. These dear folks didn't know anything about money. They didn't use it. So he put in a store and let the patients work in the store to make change and to sell things and to buy things and to develop their skills, their crafts. It was very in education. The fourth aspect of the program, they didn't know that it was a communicable disease. They didn't, so we taught them the simplest thing was the spit in the can, not on the floor. And we had charts and books and their characters, not the white man's character in a book to train the Eskimo how to do it. All of the things that I'm telling you are wonderful in themselves, but the wonderful side of it all is the people. Just think of going into a community and x-raying everybody and finding out this one and that one and that one had active positive sputum. They had to come out, be sent to Seward Sanatorium, never to return because they were so far advanced. It was impossible to cure them, but we were isolating the positive sputum cases from spreading it to the rest of the family. And it wouldn't be unusual at all for us in a family of six to find two that were active sputum positive, and the others were trying to cope with it and were able to arrest it in their own bodies. But that's why I say they deserved a lot of the credit, and they knew that. And great was the day when we were able to cure somebody and send them back home.
They often knew that they were giving up their family forever.
That's right. Giving up their family forever. And we even sent them to Chicago because we were able to get beds there. Even sent them to Seattle, especially crippled children. And that's why And anything you write, we should give those people the great credit for cooperating with the program. Coming down first and being x-rayed, then being sent home to a sanatorium. Many so far advanced they died.
So that was pretty heroic.
Yes, indeed. Because it was done on such a mass scale, these things happened elsewhere, but here it was a whole territory that was involved. It's really quite a dramatic public health story. And we found and estimated that there were roughly 4,000 cases, and decided that out of the 4,000 cases, at least 1,000 beds were needed. And that was our reason for going to Seattle. We had Skagway, Seward, and Sitka, Mount Edgecombe Hospital. Now at Mount Edgecombe Hospital, there were two things. There was a Navy hospital of 100 beds, a beautiful permanent hospital. And we managed to get that from the Department of Interior in the Navy for a crippled children's hospital. And Dr. Philip Moore, I hired him as an orthopedic surgeon to run that hospital. And Dr. Mill, that you mentioned earlier today, also went out into the boondocks working for the state, for the Territorial Health Department, to find the cases and select the ones that went to Sitka, and of course treated those that when they were in the field. Philip Moore went out, and so did Dr. Mills. Now Moore is the man that developed a technique of taking the ribs that were thrown away by the thoracic surgeons and grinding them up and making a bone bank, a very unusual clinical procedure. But a bone bank meant that he preserved it by freezing and would go off to Kotzebue or to Bethel, where there were hospitals, and operate on tuberculosis of the spine or the leg or the knee or the hip, and use the bone as a graft that he was taking out of the chest of other patients somewhere else, isn't it?
Like a kind of paste or something?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you still see humpback Eskimos from tuberculosis of the spine, but we had good many around in those days, and that's what it was. It was the bone that would help heal. And he had his cases of frozen bone that he had ground up and use it for plastic surgery, not plastic, but corrective surgery. That's a unique one in medicine.
Was that adopted elsewhere then?
I don't know. I know bone grafts are done, but usually it's taking it out of the same person. And where is there in the United States thoracoplasties done then as we were doing them? They were very, very rarely the combination. We had the orthopedic cases and the thoracoplasties. Well, this permitted us in about 10 years to reduce the death rate, which had been around 650 per 100,000, to 60 per 100,000. Statistically, that's a rate, not numbers. And just to bring you up to date, tuberculosis, among a population that was so riddled with it in those days, 50 years ago, still has people living who are 60 and 70 today that had tuberculosis then. And they were controlled. We never cure tuberculosis, we always control it. And some of these older people the health department is finding are breaking down and causing little spotty outbreaks of tuberculosis in Alaska. And so it's an never-ending control program. And it's controlled today by skin testing, and that's how they find out when an outbreak is occurring. Chest x-rays are always monitored at the hospital. So, but the real thing that happened in the 10 years with this intensive program, thanks to the federal government, the state government, and the people. So it's a great story. And now, don't let me give you the impression that tuberculosis was all we had to do. We had pediatric problems of children. We hired pediatricians to take care of infectious diseases and childhood diseases. And sanitation was a major undertaking. It seemed absolutely insurmountable to be able to train the people living in the isolated areas about the hygiene of water and having good sanitation. Instead of going up river, going down river and taking ice out of the river, go upstream and get it. Just simple things like that needed to be taught. And I like to give credit to the Alaska National Guard, who were men that had been trained in some kind of leadership, and they went in and they used to be our village sanitarians, sanitary aides, we'd call them. The forerunners of the community health aides that we have today. These sanitary aides would teach the people about hygiene and not spitting on the floor and getting the water from a safe place and disposing of wastes. A honey bucket was put in a place that it wasn't going to get contaminated by the dogs or by people. And all of those things, intestinal diseases were very bad. Low hemoglobin from fish tapeworm and tapeworms. And that through health education and local leadership by the National Guardsmen was a great success story too.
Nowadays, have most of those educational programs taken root? People in rural Alaska have gotten that message?
My friend, the worst thing in my judgment that's being lost in Alaska is health education. And I've so reported to the state government. I was asked by Dr. Helen Byrne when she was commissioner here in the last few years to survey the state public health programs, and that's the one primary recommendation I had. And out of that came my alcohol work, because I found out to my horror when I went back in the mid-70s to do these, late-70s, to do these alcohol, to do a review of the health program, which I was under contract to do for the state. And to my utter amazement, the effect of alcohol abuse was just indescribable. And as a result of that, I did further surveys for Barrow, Kotzebue, Nome, Dillingham, and Ketchikan, and written reports, not recommending the program, but just getting the facts together. And here I discovered that the health education division of this Division of Public Health was very minimal. We've got a young population. We need education and nutrition and alcohol and drug abuse and infectious disease control. the whole package of health education, which worked with the natives. But it's not being done as a major program in the state now.
How is it that way during your tenure, when resources were much more limited than they are now, that education was more of a priority?
Well, simple story about don't spit in the floor. That's education. We had to have it.
But now the state is rich. Why aren't they?
I don't know. It's a mystery to me. And it's something that I have urged constantly, because I have been an educator. I've taught in medical school and see the wisdom of what we call prospective preventive medicine. And now it's being taught in many schools. And we're not doing it, especially when it be so valuable in returns because of the young population, the childbearing age for mothers. And I hope it comes. But you see, the division of public health is only a part of a big department. And it's epidemiology and infectious disease and tuberculosis control. And there's been some awful splintering in Alaska on health. Sanitation is not in the health department anymore, and things of this kind. It's unfortunate. There ought to be a department of health. That's what we should have. And welfare by itself. Corrections is by itself now, but health and welfare ought to be separated. It sure does. And it's something that, you know, if we've got to cut, well, we can cut that. That isn't plugging up the wall that's leaking, you know. But it's the one that's going to pay off in the long run. And it certainly did in tuberculosis and in sanitation. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I remember Barrow commissioning a study on alcoholism. 8 years ago, and then rejecting the findings of the report. And I'm wondering if acceptance of the problem is a big part of the problem in rural communities.
Well, there's always the loud-speaking advocate of self privileges, personal rights. And a result of my work and others at the same time, we got the local option law passed. The local option law now is going to be interesting for you and me to follow, because the natives wanted it. And we got it for them about 82, in which they could vote no importation and no sale in my village. And I guess about 100 of them have voted that way. But now they're finding out, these persons that are referred to sometimes as bootleggers are bringing in the liquor and selling it in these villages. So now I get the tundra drums from Bethel. There are hearings being held to have no possession in such villages. Let them vote on no possession, so that when a bootlegger has a case of whiskey, he could be arrested for having it in that dry town. Now they can circumvent the need for somebody who will not abuse alcohol by limiting the amount of possession. That's possible. I don't know what the legislature is going to do, but it's always a great industry that is trying to not care what happens to the consumer, fighting these kind of amendments. Arrested. Controlled.
Tuberculosis was the key public health issue when you were commissioner. If you were commissioner now in the